You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
And welcome to The Exchange, everybody. I am Brian Sullivan. Here's what's ahead. Stocks lower, though the Dow just briefly went positive. Yields higher. And Bitcoin cracking 72K for the first time ever, all while volatility ticks up. With earnings now mostly in the rearview mirror, what is the next catalyst for the markets and your money? And what should you do now? Your market strategist brings some buys. $8. That is the new cap for credit card late fees, thanks to a new rule for the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, but the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Bankers Association, and some other groups have already filed suit against it. We'll speak with Rohit Chopra. He's the director of the CFPB about what is next. Plus, Congress expected to vote on TikTok's fate here in America, the streamers nearly shutting out of last night's Oscars, and a new partnership. We'll speak with former TikTok CEO Kevin Mayer and entrepreneur Gary Vaynerchuk. All that's ahead, but we begin with today's market action. Let's get that to Bob Pisani on the floor, as always, on the NYSE.
Brian, good to see you, old buddy. The major indexes, let's take a look at the mixed. We had a choppy day for the S&P 500, but it's been led by consumer staple stocks. That's nice to see. Materials have been strong. Energy's been strong recently, and banks. Now, tech's lagging. The NASDAQ is struggling to get positive, but it can't quite make it. And the Dow is trying to rally in the middle of the day, but it's been weighed down by a couple of names. Boeing's down about $7. Caterpillar's down about $5 today. So we've had a mixed day in technology. Big cap tech, as you see, are mixed. Apple's up for most of the day. NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, Meta to the downside. Other big names with big momentum also slowing down a bit. I've been noting industrials have had a great run, certain ones, GE, Eaton, Textron, Dover, great momentum all this year. All of them are up double digits, but they're showing some signs of running out of steam. So maybe this momentum game is slowing a little bit, even outside of tech. Instead, the laggards for the year have been doing a little bit better in the last few days, including Paramount Global. Remember that one? That hit multi-year lows last week. It's now up 4 days in a row. Humana hit four-year lows last week. It's up 2% today. And some of the consumer staple names are doing a little bit better. J.M. Smucker's up about 5% in the last few days. Starbucks near a multi-year low last week. It's up a little bit today. Elsewhere, Bitcoin, another new high over 72,000. The spot Bitcoin ETFs started trading in mid-January at roughly 43,000. Boy, what a run that's been. Spot Bitcoin ETF flows have been strong since they started trading in mid-January. BlackRock's iShares, Fidelity, ARK, Bitwise getting the bulk of those inflows right now. Grayscale started with $27 billion in its Grayscale Trust and converted to an ETF that's seen nearly $10 billion in outflows. Quite a one run there, Brian.
Well, we got the Reddit IPO roadshow. I'm sure in your private time on a Friday night, you're just all over the Reddit boards, Bob. I know you secretly on the Grateful Dead Reddit channel. What do you make? What's the commentary like about Reddit's IPO?
Look, I hope Reddit does well because people will interpret it as a sign the IPO market is opening or not opening. Here's the problem. The company is very middle-aged. It started in 2005. They filed in 2021. The height of the social media craze was 2019 to 2021. I wish they would have gone public a few years ago. I am very excited, though, about another a company that's going public next week, Astera Labs on NASDAQ, probably next Wednesday. So this company is the whole AI story. They make what's called advanced connectivity semiconductors for data centers. What is that? They help the data centers, the semiconductors they make, help the data centers move data around quicker and more efficiently. My heaven, is that a great story? You got AI in there, and you've got the semiconductor story all at the same time. This is the first big AI-related IPO of the year. In my opinion, Brian, that's the one to watch right now.
That is the one to watch. If you say it, we buy it. Bob Pisani, thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. The Magnificent Seven continues to be magnificent, mostly. As a group, they're up another 14% this year. But even with that, JP Morgan analysts saying the Mag 7 stocks are not any more expensive than the rest of the market. But your next guest says there are some red flags beginning to pop up. Let's talk about that and more. Joining us now to kick it off is Julie Beal, Chief Market Strategist and Fund Manager at Kayne Anderson Rudnick and a CNBC contributor. Julie, good to see you. What are some of these red flags?
I think some of the concerns that I have are in terms of the valuation. You know, I recognize that these industries are generating real earnings today from AI. NVIDIA is generating very, very powerful earnings. And so if we look at that multiple on an earnings basis, it doesn't look wacky or crazy. But the expectations around that multiple are very high, both in terms of the revenue growth and the margin expansion. And I think if you get a whiff of any softness in that momentum, that valuation suddenly looks very expensive. It happens kind of very quickly. So, you know, my concern is think of valuations in terms of expectations. If there's anything my parents learned, it's that having high expectations can really set you up for disappointment in the long term. You got to be careful in managing those. And that's a little bit my concern here is, you know, we just expect AI to be on this kind of straight line path of growth, but we don't have a ton of business use cases for it just yet. We don't really know how it's going to filter through the system. This is not dissimilar from when the internet first came out, right? We didn't know if the best use case was going to be for cat memes or transportation logistics networks, right? It wasn't clear. And I think we're still at that point here with AI where we're not sure exactly what the use cases are going to be.
Yeah, no, that's certainly a great point. You're not telling people to avoid all the mags, or should we? I guess we got to we take Tesla out? Is it the Super Six or Fab Five or the Fantastic Four or the Terrific Three? Or I mean, how low do we go here, Julie?
I think it's more a function of looking at all of these businesses and not being exceptionally overweight, right? I think this is kind of the challenge of owning the indexes right now is how overweight and how exposed you are to these businesses and the hopes and expectations around them, right? I would argue that Tesla is not really an AI play. It's still a car manufacturer with much more increasing competition in its space, and it still has to just bend the metal. It's just not a profitable business in the same way that a software business is. So I would take that out. But I think writ large, you have a lot of exposure when you own these passive indexes. And so you just want to balance that and make sure that you own other businesses that are not as expensive and don't have as high of hopes around them.
All right, let's talk about a couple of names that you do like. And these are unique names, but they've also had big runs. Simpson Manufacturing. I guess if you're not a home builder, you probably don't know who they are. They're basically building materials. SSD is the ticker. They've doubled in a year. A boring old industrial, and it's not scaring you off.
No, because I think that the long-term fundamentals around home building are still very positive. We are still very much underhoused, and that's something that has been structurally in play since the global financial crisis. We just do not have enough houses for the amount of population growth that we have, and supply has been really constrained because of high rates. People are just stuck in their houses with their low mortgages. There's no movement. So you've seen fundamentals for both the home builders and the building services providers that, you know, support that doing really, really well. I think that can continue because I still think that the long-term outlook for those businesses is very solid. And, you know, Simpson is a great case of that where they have 70% market share with their product and they have been pricing before inflation was really a thing. They really have a lot of pricing power in that business.
Yeah, and I guess they probably supply to Dreamfinders Homes, which is another name that you brought for us today. They call themselves America's premier home builder. I'm sure every home builder says they're the premier home builder, but that stock's up 209%.
Yeah, right. But I think, again, like it has the right exposure in terms of where its markets are in South, and it's about the right price point, right? We know that millennials have not been able to access housing, and housing is such a central tenet of wealth creation in the U.S. So there is so much pent-up demand. So I think they're in the right place. I think they have the right type of product. And what's great about this business is they don't land bank. So the risk that if we do have a sudden correction in the housing market is much lower for this business because they don't have a lot of structural costs and they don't have the balance sheet risk.
Julie, really appreciate you coming on, kicking off our coverage on the show and the week. Julie Beal, Kane Anderson Rudnick. Have a great week. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Meantime, the Department of Justice opening a criminal investigation into the January incident when a door plug blew off that Boeing 737 MAX 9 during the Alaska Airlines flight. Phil LeBeau joining us now with more. Phil.
And Brian, this is an investigation about the Alaska Airlines door plug blowout, but it's also a broader review of Boeing. So let me take you through exactly what's happening here. First of all, as I mentioned, they are looking into the January 5th event. I say they, the Department of Justice. Part of that review of the Alaska Airlines door plug incident is interviewing Alaska Airlines crew members as well as passengers on that flight. And there's a broader Boeing review. So let's talk first about the Alaska Airlines incident. You might be saying to yourself, wait a second, didn't the NTSB already determined that there were no bolts in the door plug? That was a preliminary conclusion from the NTSB. The full final investigation from the NTSB, that's going to be coming at some point in the future. They have not concluded their investigation. Meanwhile, for Boeing and for the DOJ, part of the focus here is the agreement that Boeing made with the Department of Justice back in 2021, a settlement into what happened that caused the two MAX crashes in 2018 and 2019. And as part of that settlement, Boeing agreed to pay $2.5 billion and agree to certain stipulations. As you take a look at shares of Boeing, we should point out that neither Boeing nor the Department of Justice are commenting about the current investigation. But Brian, part of that agreement, that deferred prosecution agreement, was that Boeing would not be charged with conspiracy to commit fraud against the FAA for 3 years if it kept its nose clean. Essentially, was following the rules of the laws, working with regulators, et cetera. So what the DOJ is likely looking into, we don't know for sure because the DOJ is not commenting on this investigation. What they're likely looking into is, are you really following all the laws that were there, the regulators, working with the FAA inspectors as you should be? Or were you in violation of that agreement in 2021, which, again, was for 3 years, and so it's not expired, which is why the DOJ can still come back to him and say, look, we think you're in violation of the deferred prosecution agreement from 2021. That's a possibility. Not saying it's going to happen, but it's a possibility.
I'm trying to think, and this is your world, so you would know, Phil, when there's been a criminal investigation into any kind of an airline. I remember some, I think, with car companies.
Well, there was one, Brian, that's what the 2018-2019 MAX investigations were. That was a criminal
investigation by the
DOJ.
By our DOJ, even though the accidents both occurred on you know, other nations,
Correct. Airlines
in
Correct.
Other nations.
And it had to do with the development of the 737 MAX, whether or not Boeing withheld information that it should have revealed to airlines, to customers, et cetera. And then ultimately, this settlement was reached in 2021, again, for $2.5 billion, as well as certain stipulations in terms of how Boeing would conduct itself over the next 3 years.
Wow. So really the second criminal investigation into Boeing in about 5 or 6 years. Remarkable. Phil LeBeau, thank you. All right, we got a lot more to do. And on deck, the government going after sky-high credit card fees, and now they're setting their sights on closing costs for mortgages. Plus, we're going to ask CSPB Director Rohit Chopra what this will all look like, whether or not it's going to happen, and what it means when you buy your home. Plus, the company behind Coco Melon is out with a new generation of children's entertainment. We're going to talk about that, maybe a little bit about Disney and TikTok with Gary Vaynerchuk and former TikTok CEO Kevin Mayer later on in the show. We are back right after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
All right. The average FICO credit score dropped for the first time in a decade last week. Now, don't make too much of it. It was only 1 point from 718 to 717. But it comes as credit card debt now tops $1 trillion. And if you pay late, you know you get whacked with some big fees, but likely not anymore. The CFPB is cracking down on late fees to a maximum of $8 from an average of $32 right now. Joining us now is the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Rohit Chopra. Commissioner, thanks for joining us. There's some lawsuits against it, Chamber of Commerce, I think, Bankers Association. I can understand the latter, maybe not as much the former. Is this the law now? Is this happening? Will it happen?
Well, what we found was that big credit card issuers were exploiting a loophole for years and years, and it allowed them to haul in $14 billion in late fees on top of the extra interest they charge on late payments. And in addition to slamming people's credit reports and imposing other consequences. So what we've done is we have narrowed that exemption to make it a little bit more fair for consumers and the entire market. Look, you're right. People owe about $1 trillion. They know they got to pay that, and they got to pay it with interest. What we don't want is credit card companies creating a business model where they're cheering when their consumers are paying late.
So is this enacted now, or is it still something that's being proposed and may not occur, or is this now how it's going to be?
So we've finalized the rule. It will take effect in a few months. But as you mentioned, lobbyists are suing to stop it. And look, that's no surprise. We have seen how companies that rely on junk fees are pushing back hard. But we've got to do our job to make sure that consumers are fairly treated.
And then we had hinted about closing costs on homes. If you could write it up, if you could, and you probably can. I mean, you are the commissioner. You got a team behind you, and you got to get it approved. What do you want to do around home closing costs?
Well, here's what we're finding across the country is that people are needing to come up with big down payments, but we've noticed in our analysis quite a jump in closing costs. So we're taking a close look about all the money you pony up, those thousands of dollars at closing. And here's my concern, Brian. If you have to put thousands of dollars at closing, that's going to make your monthly mortgage payment bigger because it essentially shrinks your down payment. We also see homeowners at closing asking, what the heck is this fee that I am paying? So we're looking at these credit report fees. We're looking at other costs and also want to make sure that consumers have ways to reduce them so that they can afford that monthly mortgage payment. Across the country, you see homes are expensive. And a lot of first-time home buyers are wondering, with these interest rates, what are they going to do? We started to see mortgage rates go down, but I don't want to see down payments being siphoned away in closing costs that don't make sense.
And what's the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's beef with this credit card plan?
Well, you'd have to ask them, but here's what we're seeing. A lot of challenges to rules across the board that protect consumers. And it's a classic story where those companies who have built a business model on these fees, they are ready to push back hard so that they can hold on to those billions. At the end of the day, I think regulators, policymakers just want a competitive market where people know the price up front and that everyone is following the law. So, Brian, we're just going to keep doing what we're doing on bank accounts, credit cards, mortgages, and all the other products that we have to serve as the watchdog for.
Well, listen, 32 to 8 sounds pretty good to a lot of people, especially that get whacked with those. Rohit Chopra, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Director, really appreciate you coming on. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Brian.
All right, be well. All right, in the meantime, bank stocks under a little pressure today, along with most of the rest of the market. Following a very volatile week, shares of New York Community Bank, well, they are down again, all as we hit the one-year anniversary of the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. But your next guest sees some optimism for mid-cap banks with potential rate cuts expected later on this year. Jared Shaw is a mid-cap bank analyst at Barclays. He just initiated on the group with a positive view. And welcome him on, Jared. It's a bigger story than just the stocks that you cover. I think New York Community Bank really shook a lot of people up. We thought the worst was behind us a year ago. Now we have this again. But is NYCB an NYCB-specific issue?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Brian. Good afternoon. I do think it is. I think there's some very unique aspects to the NYCB story. The first is they have grown over the $100 billion threshold very rapidly over the last year and a half, partly from two acquisitions. So as they've grown into this bigger size, they also changed their regulator to the OCC. And with that comes different requirements and maybe a different way of looking at things. So I think part of what you've seen with NYCB is growing pains. as they've grown into this bigger size. But it's really not reflective of the broader market. You brought up the one-year anniversary, and you saw the strain that a liquidity crisis put on a handful of banks last year. And when you look at the group overall, the banks have been very resilient over the last year. They've continued to grow capital. They've implemented a very strong, robust liquidity plan. So I think when you look at the mid-cap banks overall, they are in a very strong position to be able to go forward. And I think, you know, NYCB is dealing with some idiosyncratic issues that are unique to them.
Yeah, and one of your key overweights is a bank that really got kind of caught up when the tide went out last year, and that is Western Alliance Bank. Did they fix something, or were they just misunderstood by much of the market last year, Jared?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you look at what happened last year, it was really the banks that had disproportionate business tied with the innovation economy. So with the startup tech companies and with the private equity and venture capital funds that funded those companies. So that's where you saw a lot of concentration in deposits. Western Alliance did have some pressure there. You saw deposit outflows in March, but what they did really well was having a diversified deposit base. They also communicated really well with the street. They gave us updates on deposits. They gave us updates on liquidity and contingent liquidity. So they, you know, I think really did a great job of building their credibility and separating themselves from the banks that had very high concentration to those businesses. As we've come forward through the year, they still have exposure to the innovation economy, but they've actually been able to recoup some of those deposits. So, you know, they're back in that game. Mm-hmm. But again, it's just not enough that it determines the whole course of their focus.
I know most of the names on your list, but I'm not going to lie, never heard of Webster Financial, WBS. Jared, usually don't like to admit that I don't know something, but literally never heard of them, have know nothing about them, but you like them.
I do, yeah. So Webster is a Connecticut headquartered bank. Over the years, they've done deals expanding into Massachusetts, and then a year and a half ago, they acquired the former Sterling Financial in the metro New York area. So Webster is a bank that has a good geographic focus in the Northeast. They also have some unique national business lines, especially on the funding side. So, you know, one of the big themes that we've been looking at over the last few years is the strength of funding, the deposit base. Webster is the leader in the health savings account business. So those are the long duration, low cost deposit bases tied to high deductible healthcare plans. So they're a leader there. That's really a differentiator for them on the funding side. They've also done some recent acquisitions on funding that have developed more of a niche, low cost funding base for them. So, you know, as we look at how the banks have been able to manage through this higher rate environment, the ones that have the lowest cost funding, the most stable funding, are the ones that are outperforming, and we think Webster will continue to be able to do that.
There you go. Jared Shaw, Barclays, appreciate your views. Thank you very much, Jared, for coming on.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, speaking of banks, some of them are teaming up with clean energy companies to try to fight the proposed bank capital rules. DC correspondent Emily Wilkins is actually in studio here. Good to see you, Emily. Odd bedfellows, I think. Clean energy and banks.
It truly is, Brian. I mean, banks and renewable energy companies, they're sounding this alarm that a proposed framework for increasing bank capital requirements is going to wind up pumping the brakes on green energy projects. So the majority renewable energy systems, like this one that we're seeing here at Gallaudet University in D.C., they rely on banks to help with funding, and they do so through tax equity investments, a $20 billion market that actually could double in coming years, according to the American Council on Renewable Energy. So in return, the banks then benefit from federal tax credits that promote renewables. The issue is that the updated capital requirements framework would quadruple how much banks need to hold in reserve for every dollar they spend on these projects. So JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and others have said that this is going to limit their ability to invest in green energy. Julian Torres, the chief investment officer at Scale Microgrids, who helped design and build Gallaudet's system, said it would ultimately impact wider climate goals and the ability to just have an impact with renewable energy.
Basel III would unwind a lot of the progress made by the Biden administration with the Inflation Reduction Act in 2022. And it would make projects inefficient or uneconomic, in the current environment for financing.
Dominic Lacey, Gallaudet's chief operating officer, said the university is saving about $1 million a year since it switched to a renewable energy system.
If we didn't have access to that tax credit, we would have had to figure out a different way to replace the infrastructure, and it would have been incredibly difficult. We would not have been able to move as quickly as we did. And quite frankly, I don't know that we would have been able to replace our energy at the scale in which we did.
Now, Powell did tell lawmakers that he thought that any impact on climate change from the framework would be minimal, but he said he was well aware of the commentary and concerns, and Brian will be following what happens there.
So the idea is that we want to build out these energy projects. They're expensive, and the banks are saying these new rules are going to be counterproductive to our climate goals.
Exactly. Banks are saying, hey, we're happy right now to back these green energy projects. They're doing the bulk of that work to really get these projects off the ground. But if capital requirements are going to quadruple, you'll need $4 in reserve instead of just having $1 in reserve. Banks are going to say, look, thanks, but no thanks. This is a little bit much for us. And of course, that's concerning the renewable energy groups a lot to have this roadblock to getting so many of their projects done.
And it's already hard enough because the cost of money has gone up. A big fight. Let us know how it plays out. Emily, thank you.
Thanks so much,
Good
Brian.
To see you at the mothership.
It's always good to be here.
I like it down there. All right, still ahead. Here's a look at your mystery chart of the day. Investors not liking the multi-billion dollar deal that this company just announced. Do you know who the mystery chart may be? It's our Wordle of the day. You can tweet us at the show account or Sully CNBC. We are back right after this. All right, hope you're having a good Monday wherever you are. Guess what? The Dow is having a better Monday than it was this morning. It opened up negative, but we are positive right now. It is 0.09% to the positive, but is positive nonetheless. United Health, Nike, Disney, all up more than 2%. The big laggard is BA, Boeing. Just more problems. You heard Phil talk about that criminal investigation. All right, now let's get to Tyler Matheson for a CNBC News update.
Brian, thank you very much. The Biden administration proposed a 2025 budget today, totaling $7.26 trillion. That's up from last year. The budget devotes more funds to Social Security and child care costs, as well as small business loans. And it includes $900 billion in defense spending. White House also expects to raise about $5.5 trillion, due in part from proposed tax hikes on corporations and the wealthy. Donald Trump has asked to delay his hush money trial until the Supreme Court rules on his presidential immunity claim. The trial is set to begin in New York City later this month. The former president pleaded not guilty to more than 300 counts of falsifying business records. And U.S. auto safety regulators are investigating complaints of brake issues on two Honda models. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is looking into the automatic emergency brakes stopping without warning on more than 250,000 Passport and Honda Insight models from 2019 to 22. Honda said it's cooperating and conducting its own review. Brian, back to you.
All right, Tyler, we'll see you in Power Lunch here in about a half an hour. Thank you.
You bet.
All right, coming up, call it full stream ahead. Gary Vaynerchuk, Kevin Mayer teaming up. They're here to talk about their latest venture. And as we celebrate Women's Heritage Month, we are sharing the stories of some of our newly named CNBC Changemakers, an annual list of 50 women who are innovating and transforming business. Here is lead co-founder, CEO, Jackie Reses.
As someone who is a changemaker, it means someone who's pushing the boundaries of innovation, changing the way things work and having a new vision for how business should be done around the world. You know, I feel like I operate with grace, humility, with execution, with grit, and I'm not sure that's something that can be defined by gender. I think as a female leader, more than anything, is that I want people to look at me and say leadership can look different than maybe they expected.
And welcome back to The Exchange. The company behind CoComelon announcing a new partnership with entrepreneur Gary Vaynerchuk and agreeing to produce content based on his V Friends universe. Joining us now to talk about that and a lot more is the man himself, Gary Vaynerchuk, along with Candle Media co-CEO Kevin Mayer, of course, with our own Julia Boorstin. Julia, take it away.
Thanks so much, Brian. Gary and Kevin, thanks so much for joining me here today. We have so much to discuss with you two, but let's start off with the news. Gary, what is this partnership? Why does it make sense for your business?
You know, my mission is to make people fall in love with the VeeFriends characters. If I don't get the world to fall in love with Rare Robot or Patient Panda, then the mission isn't accomplished. And the collectibilities of the original NFTs and other things we do becomes mute. And so teaming up with Kevin and team like Moonbug, obviously I don't have to tell any parent that's watching this how much consumption and love for Cocomelon and other things they do. And just like morning cartoons in the 70s on Saturdays or after school in the 80s or Nickelodeon later, if you don't win in the medium where cartoons are being consumed, you lose. And YouTube Kids is the most important platform for me, and I'm teaming up with the best.
Is teaming up with Kevin Mayer here. Kevin, you know, you have unique perspective on the kids content space, not only because of Cocomelon and Moonbug, but also because not only were you at Disney for many years, but you are currently serving as an advisor to Bob Iger, CEO of Disney. Given all of that, what is the opportunity you see here, and why does it make sense to be partnering with Gary?
Well, I think Gary's the best, actually. He's very kind to call Moonbug the best kids media company. And we are. We have a huge presence on YouTube. Some of the biggest YouTube channels in the world are under our Moonbug banner, which is part of our larger Candle Media company. And we think VeeFriends will fit in really well. It's a little bit older. It skews older at 6 to 11, as you can see here. It's a character universe invented by what I think is one of the foremost social media entrepreneurs that we've ever seen. And social media is really where our IP starts. It starts on YouTube. We expand it to streaming services with film and TV length programming. And then we make a lot of product. You can see some of it behind me here on the in the video. It's a content to commerce play that flows right through social media. That's what Candle Media strategy is. And I think there's no better entrepreneur or media personality or executive than Gary to be our partner in this.
Well, speaking of social media, I have to ask you both about TikTok. Of course, Kevin, you used to be the CEO of TikTok for a relatively brief stint. And Gary, you create a lot of content that's distributed through TikTok and other social platforms. The House is now set to vote on Wednesday, day after tomorrow, on a bill that would give ByteDance about 6 months to divest TikTok or face a ban. Gary, what would this do to you and your business on TikTok?
Well, it's funny, I've just right over my shoulder, a book I have coming out later this year, Day Trading Attention, which is great for this audience. You know, to me, you know, I just focus on where the consumer's attention is. And so whether it's on television or streaming or on specific social networks, all of those hours of attention would have to find a new home. And obviously I believe Meta and X and others would be big winners of such a reality. Obviously deciding what to do with TikTok is above my pay grade, and I'll leave that to the politicians. But if it happens, the next day I wake up and I start day trading attention and I find where that attention went.
So you're going to go where the eyeballs are, Gary. But Kevin used to run this company. I have two questions for you, Kevin. Is one, what do you think will happen? And the second, what do you think should happen? There's been some speculation that Bobby Kotick, who used to run Activision Blizzard, could lead a buyout of TikTok.
Well, I'm not sure what will happen. As Gary just said, it's above my pay grade, too. It's resting with the government, with the legislature right now. It seems to pass pretty robustly in committee. Doesn't get more robust than a unanimous, you know, sort of cross-party decision. It seems to unify the two parties. I don't know what will happen when it traverses through the Congress and then the Senate. I guess Biden's administration has said he will sign it if it comes to his desk. So this looks somewhat real. Whether it should happen or not, again, above my pay grade. But I've always had difficulty believing that TikTok posed this sort of the dire national security threat that has been posed by certain people. So I've never been a believer in that, but then again, it's above my pay grade. It's going to be an expensive purchase if there is a buyout. Remember what happened last time. There was also a buyout ordered by Trump via a presidential decree. This was not via legislation, so I think it might be different this time around. Back then, it was a much less expensive asset, and you could see an Oracle or Microsoft teamed up with Walmart. Those are the two buyers last time, you may recall. They had the capability to buy this company. At this point, it is a juggernaut. is going to, the intrinsic value of TikTok is in the hundreds of billions, probably at this point. It's not clear to me who can or would buy it in the first place. Private equity will be have a very difficulty, a lot of difficulty coming up with that quantum of money. And then again, yes, you still have the problem with the Chinese government perhaps not allowing a sale should it be forced by the U.S. government. That's exactly what happened last time around. They created a new law that put the export of the type of code that TikTok develops needing to have export licenses. And of course, they weren't going to issue those export licenses. So it's a complicated dance among governments, money providers, capital provisioning. It's very difficult. So what will actually happen here if the ban is put into effect? I don't know.
Yeah, well, the other complicated dance going on in your world, Kevin, is this proxy battle with Disney. There's the shareholder meeting coming up. Nelson Peltz is attacking this company. What do you think is going to happen there?
Oh, I think Bob Iger wins this one hands down. I don't think, you know, Nelson over the years has proven to be a really savvy investor, a very, very helpful voice in some boardrooms. I don't think he would be a helpful voice in this boardroom. This is a very specific industry. A lot of specific vertical industry knowledge is required to add value in a boardroom setting like this. I also think it would be highly disruptive. And I also believe that Bob has taken all the steps necessary to right the ship. And it's already becoming obvious, not only in the share price, but in the morale of the company, the positioning of the company within the greater entertainment universe. I think that Bob and his key lieutenants, that he has a great team there, have done a remarkable job in repositioning the company for success. And I don't think they need the disruption of a Peltz or the other guys that are in there either. I don't think he needs them. And I think he will win only.
Well, it'll be a fascinating battle to watch that play out. And Gary, a question for you back to this announcement today. Your V Friends characters, they're based on NFTs or were originally really connected to the NFTs. We've seen that NFT market really decline. But what's your outlook for the NFT market now? And how important are NFTs to building this franchise with Moonbug and Candle Media?
You know, I was on this program 2 years ago at the height of NFTs saying 99% of NFTs were going to go to zero because 99% of sports cards aren't worth anything. 99% of contemporary art are not collectible. 99% of sneakers and watches and comic books. You know, for me, Series 1 NFT V Friends is the holy grail collectible in my world. They're incredibly important. You know, the ability of using the blockchain in the future as it becomes a more mass consumer product is going to be imperative. And I'm excited as we get more clarity on what I can and can't do with the NFTs in the future, play out to navigate those waters and execute on the value. And so to me, getting these characters popular is the next 10, 15, 20 years of my life for sure. And then just like, you know, the first appearance of Batman in Detective Comics or a Mickey Mantle rookie card, forever and ever, the first series NFT V Friends with my original sketches is the holy grail collectible. And then obviously there's blockchain technology that allows me to do future things based on how we can really navigate those waters. And so I'm excited about that. And so it's imperative. It is the holy grail collectible of this universe, even though I will make it an omni universe that is featured in films and theme parks and all that. You know, it's fun to be with Kevin and talk about this. The blueprint's out there. I've got to execute on it.
And now you have this new partnership. Well, we appreciate you joining us to tell us about that and share your perspective on these various industries. Gary Vaynerchuk, Kevin Mayer, thanks so much. And Brian, I'm going to send it back over to you.
All right, Julia, Gary, Kevin, great stuff. Really appreciate it. Thank you. All right, on deck. One of America's top real estate moguls will join us in what he is seeing 30 stories above Park Avenue. As we head to break, check out Xcel Energy getting upgrades from both Barclays and Wolf Research to buy equivalents today. Both firms saying liabilities from massive Texas fires should be less than feared, but they also warn future fire risks will keep shares trading at a discount. By the way, exactly what we warned about in our mini documentary. It's about 12 minutes long. We rolled it out 3 weeks ago. I urge you to go check it out. It's on CNBC.com. The exchange will be right back. All right, welcome back. America's biggest natural gas producer, EQT, was the mystery chart that we just showed you. It's having its worst day in about 2 years. Company announcing an all-stock deal to buy back its former pipeline business called Equitrans. Combined companies expect to be worth more than $35 billion and reunites the two after Equitrans was spun out of EQT in 2018. We're going to have more on the deal tonight and a reaction to it. We're joined by EQT CEO Toby Rice. That is live, 7 o'clock Eastern in Last Call. I've heard it's pretty good. Check it out. All right, coming up, the affordability crisis is solvable. That is what one real estate developer says about the housing market. What we need to do to bring prices down is next. According to the Mortgage Bankers Association, commercial real estate lending in 2023 was one for the record books, but not in a good way. It was one of the slowest years. Preliminary data shows loan originations dropping almost 50% last year to about $444 billion, still a big number. This year, not expected to look much better, but despite the tough environment, your next guest was able to secure over $800 million in construction loans last year for three different projects. Joining us now is Mickey Naftali. He's the chairman and CEO of Naftali Group. They build and sell some of the most beautiful buildings in New York and South Florida and a couple in Singapore and things like that. So, Mickey, we spoke like 15 years ago. It's good to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
Is the commercial real estate market for New York, and we'll get to Florida because they're very different things as we know, is New York back or will New York still be catching up for years to come?
New York is back big time, and when I say it, I'm referring to the residential sector.
And not the commercial.
Not the commercial sector, the residential sector. And, you know, it's the recovery in New York is quite amazing. In the last 2 years, I sold over $1.5 billion in New York, in Manhattan, and sold out. I have no inventory right now. I'm preparing an inventory on the Upper West Side, Upper East Side, in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, on the East River.
Yeah, the whole waterfront there.
Yes, correct. But just the market is, as long as you design and develop a really quality product, there is a lot of demand in New York.
You're a builder. We worry about all the empty commercial real estate. Some of these buildings are beautiful.
Right.
Some of them are ugly, okay?
You're right.
How hard is it to take a commercial office building, one that's built 50 years ago, and turn it into what you do? Or is it better just to buy it, knock it down, and start over?
So it's difficult, and I would say from 2000 to 2008, I probably converted more commercial buildings to residential use than any other developer in New York. The problem is there is no one solution to all. Some of those commercial buildings, they're very big. The floor plates are very big, which is very difficult to convert to residential because residential is all about light and air, right? How the apartments cannot be too deep and whatever. So there are certain buildings in certain locations that you can convert and certain buildings that you cannot. And perhaps the best is just to demolish them. The biggest problem is that the cost is so expensive that without incentives from the state and the city, it's almost impossible to
tax abatements.
Correct.
Like what they did downtown after 9/11.
Correct.
And is there any movement on that, or is this a New York City Council that just doesn't?
It's difficult.
They're not going to do it.
It's difficult.
You better watch. Don't say anything. You need them to be on your side. Yeah. And then Florida, again, you're building some stuff down. These projects. I'm looking at some of these projects on your website. I'm like, man, that is gorgeous.
Right.
You know? And you just wonder, and I love New York City. I love New York City. But when I also see the sun and the light and the tax rates of Florida, how hard is it to compete?
So here's the thing. I mean, there are two great markets. New York, for me, and for what we do for many years, is a really fantastic market. But what we do, we follow the demand. And the demand, there is a strong demand in New York. There is a very strong demand in South Florida and mainly in Miami. Anyway, the stretch between Miami and Palm Beach. So we have a 70-story, 1.5 million square feet project in Miami, which is very exciting. And it's all about the demand. So if you design and develop the right product and the demand is for a luxury product, you're probably going to be successful in a high demand.
And no sign of Miami demand slowing down.
There is a slowdown. There is a slowdown. But here's the thing. You spoke about financing, right? Very difficult to get financing. So construction, we managed to close $850 million last year. But it's very difficult. Only few developers can get them done.
And you can do it. And you're doing some beautiful projects, Mickey. Don't make it 15 years again. Good luck, Mickey Nefeli.
Thank you
very much. All right, that does it for The Exchange. I'll see you at 7 o'clock tonight. Power Lunch is next.